Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Scott Wiedenthal, writer and researcher specializing in birds and bird migration. And we're talking about his book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Scott, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you write, the very first sentence of this book is, this is a book about optimism, and it's funny. I have to confess, when I read that one sentence, I considered it a challenge, because as a hardcore birder, I think things are awful.
Yeah.
Like, and I've been birding for like 50 years. I mean, I'm a child of the 50s, and things are just really bad. And you write about that as right underneath that sentence about how bad things are.
Right. And I'm not suggesting things aren't dire for birds, but I also think that one of the worst things we can do is give in to despair.
Yep.
You know, we've brought some birds back from the brink in the past. We can do it again. It's incumbent on us to try. I mean, the only way it's going to be impossible to save birds is if we don't try. So let's try. And so the idea here was again, not to say things are hunky-dory, but to lay out some examples of roadmaps for recovery and, you know, suggest, all right, let's find other ways to do this with other species. I'm totally with you. We're not that far apart in age.
No.
But then again, look, I graduated high school in 1976. Bicentennial year, there were fewer than 1,000 bald eagles in the lower 48. If you had told me that by the time we were marking the 250th anniversary of the country, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles, I would have, in the spirit of the 70s, I would have asked you what you were smoking. So, you know, we've done amazing things with waterfowl. Waterfowl populations are starting to slip a little bit. The Supreme Court hasn't done them any favors with the Sackett ruling that
stripped no.
protection from federal protection from wetlands. But, you know, as recently as the 1980s, the assumption on the part of like the top waterfowl biologists in the U.S. and Canada was like, maybe we could bring them back to the middling levels of the 1950s. And instead, with, you know, the North American Wetlands Conservation Act and the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, you know, the first transnational bird conservation agreement between originally the U.S. and Canada and then bringing Mexico in, you know, we probably got more waterfowl now than at any point since the market hunting period of the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
So, but I would argue of certain species, you write about this in the book, for instance,
yeah.
greater snow geese, their numbers bounce back way too well.
Yeah.
They're to constitute now a problem.
Right. Although I will say, in the last couple of years with avian influenza,
yeah.
greater snow geese populations have taken a real hit.
And yeah, we were hit here badly.
Yeah, there's actually some concern about that. But you never know what the future is going to hold. And
that's the problem. There's all these great programs in which is what your book is about, and I always worry about the X factor that could come in and undo everything.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and avian influenza is a great example of
oh,
that.
God.
You know, we've seen it before. And, you know, I study, one of the species I study are snowy owls, and they've taken a huge
yeah.
hit
yeah.
on a population, global population, that's not that high. But we're talking about bad stuff here.
Okay, let's talk about some of the things. The thing I want to really promote for your book, and first of all, it's a great read. You do on the ground, boots on the ground, reporting from all these different locations throughout Europe and North America. And it's that aspect of this book that really sort of sets it apart from all other books about this, is that you're there and doing stuff. And that was just great. And then the variety of programs that you investigate are just really fantastic. We can't talk about even an eighth of what's in this book. But I'm going to talk about a couple of ideas that you investigate. Rewilding. You write a lot about it when you're in Britain, but also in Europe. People who have never heard the word before, give me a definition of rewilding.
Well, and it's interesting that I think a lot of North Americans haven't heard of rewilding before, because the concept actually started here with Dave Foreman and, mm-hmm. and some of those other revolutionary, echo warriors back in the 70s. The idea of, in North America, the idea was what they call the three C's, cores, corridors, and carnivores.
Mm.
Protecting core areas of wildland, building corridors between them, and bringing back large carnivores. Rewilding in Europe is a very different beast.
Yeah.
And the idea there is to work at landscape scales on, you know, as you can imagine, after, like, basically since the Bronze Age, human-modified landscapes, and that have, in many cases, have lost a lot of their large wildlife, especially their large grazing animals. We're very fortunate in North America that, you know, we still have most of the pieces. We haven't, you know, there've been some bird extinctions. There have been very few mammalian extinctions. So we still have, you know, by the skin of our teeth, bison and moose and elk and grizzly bears and all the rest of that stuff. And so rewilding in North America has mostly been trying to connect the existing big pieces of wild land.
Like areas of of grasslands.
Yeah.
And prairies. Trying to reconnect it and then reintroduce,
right,
in some cases, things that would substitute for the Pleistocene.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's the thing in, you know, in Europe, what they're trying to do is create ecological function on landscapes.
Yeah,
and we're talking huge areas of land. So one of the places I visited were the Southern Carpathian Mountains.
Oh, God.
In eastern Romania, which is, yeah.
I'm so jealous. It sounded amazing.
It's a really beautiful landscape. It's the largest, arguably the largest wild landscape south of the Arctic in Europe, but empty of a lot of its wildlife. Now, they have brown bears, they have wolves, they have deer. One of the keystone species that was missing there for more than 250 years were European bison, and I think it surprises a lot of Americans to find out that there is such a thing as a European bison,
yeah,
the biggest land animal in Europe. Even the cows weigh like 1,400 pounds. And it's a really bird-rich landscape. So, like, you mentioned Britain before. There's been a lot of rewilding going on in Britain at places like the Nepa State in Sussex in the south of England, where people, like in the case of Nep, Isabella Tree and her husband Charlie Burrell, allowed the land to kind of relax out of an agricultural landscape back into something that's more thickety and thorn scrub and wild, and as you say, using domestic analogs of lost Pleistocene species, like, you know, the original wild ox of Europe, that's the progenitor of all domestic cattle. That's been extinct since the 1600s. Ice Age horses have been gone for a very, very long time. But what Izzy and Charlie did was they brought in domestic analogs, so Old English longhorn cattle instead of aurochs, cattle that can survive out on the land 12 months of the year without being stabled. Shaggy Exmoor ponies that, again, can live, you know, they're rugged, they can live, you know, feral on the landscape. Tamworth pigs, these gigantic brick red pigs. We here in North America, we're used to thinking of wild boar as a horrific invasive species, but they're a native species. They were native to Britain. But it's illegal to release them there, so they use pigs. Anyway, all of these animals, their hooves and their teeth and their appetite, have remolded the landscape. And what we've seen at NEP on this 3,500-acre hereditary estate is, you know, this explosion of biodiversity, and particularly birds, but not just birds, but, you know, bats and bees and butterflies and beetles. Species like nightingale.
I know that one of the most important birds in literature, the nightingale,
yeah, exactly,
in poetry, and people were shocked that they're virtually extinct in Britain.
Yeah, I know, and it's painful for people of Brits of a certain age. You know, nightingales are just woven into the fabric,
yeah,
of their national identity, and they're just almost gone, except at NEP, where their population is just exploding. And in fact, NEP runs these nightingale safaris where they'll take people out at, you know, at night, because the male nightingales do these jazz-like riffs, you know, of improvisational song in the dark. And, you know, the folks at NEP said, you know, people just weep. You know, it's
wow,
connecting with their childhood that they thought was gone. Now, in back to the Southern Carpathians, that's a very bird-rich landscape. Species like nightingales and red-backed shrikes and Eurasian turtle doves that are, you know, essentially gone from Central and Western Europe are abundant there. The question is, how do you keep them abundant? Because millions of people are leaving the land. And so what had been, again, since like the Bronze Age or the Iron Age, you know, a landscape of small-scale agriculture is reverting to forest, which is great for forest birds, you know, that's super for them. But for birds of farms and villages, like the shrikes and golden orioles and some of the wagtails, that their habitat's disappearing. So the idea here that, you know, rewilding Romania is pursuing, and there's, you know, there's a Rewilding Europe, which is kind of the big over umbrella organization, and then each of the countries has its own rewilding effort. Rewilding Romania, they brought back European bison after an absence of 250 years, and they are landscape engineers. European bison are much more of a species of the ecotone. You know, they're kind of forest edges and grassy openings and small pastures, and they'll strip bark from trees, and they'll wallow, and they create openings, and so they'll, in a sense, they're gonna maintain that habitat. The hope is that they will maintain that habitat mosaic that people have been maintaining for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that they'll do it in the absence of people. Because, like I said, people are moving to the cities. People are moving abroad. They're moving away from that rural landscape. And unless they can figure out a way for nature to maintain that landscape without a lot of direct human intervention, you know, that stronghold for a lot of these otherwise quite rare European birds are going to be in trouble. And so it's an experiment. No one's entirely sure if it's going to work. One of the other things of bringing the bison back is it's restoring, you know, large ungulates to a landscape where there aren't a lot of large ungulates, and where currently there's no food for things like vultures. And so, like, vultures are extinct in Romania. They were poisoned out in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
Right.
The plan is to reintroduce them, but you need something for them to eat. And so, you know, there's a number of methods to their madness here in bringing these animals back.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Scott Wiedenthal, writer and researcher specializing in birds and bird migration. And we're talking about his book. It's a really great read, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Scott, for a second, let's, you know, people may be shocked to hear that vultures are having problems because they're probably thinking about the vultures here, the black and the turkey. But in Eurasia, many vulture species have just gone down the tube.
Yeah. In fact, the Western Hemisphere is really the only place in the world where vulture populations are healthy. You know, we've lost like 98% of the vultures in South Asia because those old world vultures, which are taxonomically different than our, they're not closely related to our new world vultures. They are highly sensitive to, you know, what are called NSAID analgesics, so, you know, drugs like diclofenac that farmers give to their cattle because if your cow doesn't have aches and pains, it gets more milk. And if that cow dies with diclofenac in its system and vultures eat it, it's astoundingly toxic to vultures. And so vulture populations in South Asia collapsed in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. Vulture populations in Africa are collapsing because of intentional and unintentional poison. People putting out poison to kill hyenas and lions that are taking their livestock, but the vultures get it. Or elephant poachers or rhino poachers who shoot an elephant and then dose the carcass with poison so that all the vultures coming in don't tip off the rangers. We really need to not take our vultures for granted. In this area, because as you say, you know, black vultures and turkey vultures are doing extremely well. You know, their ranges are moving farther and farther north with climate change. You know, we've been able to bring California condors back from the brink. You know, it's a much better image here than elsewhere. So in places like Europe, where vulture populations were decimated, you know, over the last century, century and a half, there's been slow progress, although accelerating progress in bringing them back. You know, for example, Spain in particular has done a magnificent job of restoring both cinereus vultures, yep, which is the largest species over there, and griffon vultures. There's now, you know, tens of thousands of griffon vultures in Spain, and enough of them that they can start to bring some of those into other places, like the Eastern Rhodope Mountains in Bulgaria, which was a place that I visited as well.
I'm so jealous, Scott.
Yeah, it's a magnificent landscape.
Well, you know, while we're on the subject of raptors and vultures, there you do a lot about raptors in Britain. And there, the raptors, certain species of raptors, the population has really crashed. But the main culprit here is not the usual one. It's gamekeepers.
Yeah. Well, actually, and to put this in perspective, I think it's important to recognize that overall, raptor populations in the UK have rebounded dramatically.
Like the osprey.
In the US. You know, the Brits were the first ones to figure out in the 1960s that DDT is what was driving peregrine falcons down. And so, you know, peregrine numbers have come back. Common buzzards are everywhere. Goshawks, which are two different species. Our American goshawks now considered a separate species, but our goshawk populations are in free fall in eastern North America. Goshawks have recolonized the UK, and many of those were birds that were escaped from or were released by falconers, and they've done really well. They're reintroducing osprey in parts of southern England. They've reintroduced white-tailed eagles. But you're right. There's one species
hen harriers
that is really on, you know, in the crosshairs, and that's the hen harrier. This is a bird that breeds on the moorlands of the north of England and parts of Scotland, in the same habitat where red grouse are found. And red grouse are the foundation of this very old, very exclusive, very British sport of driven grouse hunting, where, you know, in the fall, starting on the glorious 12th of August, which is, you know, the opening of the grouse season every year, you have these enormous estates. You know, some of these are 20, 30,000 acre estates, where people pay thousands and thousands of pounds to spend a day of driven grouse hunting, where you are in a what's called a butt, which is a small, it's not really a blind, it doesn't, you can see, you can be seen, but then, like, you know, all the local peasantry is out there, you know, marching slowly across the landscape, driving red grouse toward you. And, you know, in some of these places you can shoot, you know, like 150 brace. It's a two-bird brace. 150 brace of grouse in the course of the day. So anything that eats those grouse is going to come in for a world of hurt. And in much of Britain, predator control is legal. You know, foxes, stoats, crows, those can all be killed legally. You're not supposed to kill raptors, but because the hen harriers breed on the moors, and because they will take young grouse, there is a tremendous amount of illegal raptor persecution, and other species get pulled into this as well. Golden eagles in Scotland, there's a long history of golden eagle persecution, common buzzards, goshawks. It just goes on and on. And yeah, it's mostly gamekeepers. There's very little prosecution. You know, if the lord of the manse, who's, you know, got control of a 20,000 acre estate, you can understand the local police are perhaps not as anxious to investigate that politically powerful and well-connected person as they might otherwise be. So for folks like the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, and I got to spend time in the field with some of their investigations team, it's been really hard. There's very little successful prosecution of illegal bird killing. And to put this in perspective, the average lifespan for a hen harrier chick born on the moors of the north of England or in the grouse hunting areas of Scotland is about 4 months. Only about 14% of males and about 30% of female chicks make it to their first birthday. And they just disappear. They just wink out, and they almost always do so near these grouse hunting moors. It's really awful. But there's good people in the fight, and they're not giving up, and there are solutions if the English government would choose to take them. They could license these grouse moors, because what happens is the property owners say, well, heavens, it's not us.
Right.
We would never shoot a hen harrier. It must be somebody else. But there's, you know, they have no incentive to stop that shooting. And we know damn well it's the gamekeepers. Something like 68% of all the successful prosecutions have been gamekeepers. If the grouse moors were licensed, and if as a condition of their license, if there were a certain threshold of dead raptors on their property, whether it could be proven that they did it or not, they could lose their license. That would give them a very powerful incentive not to have anybody out there on their payroll or otherwise shooting raptors. Scotland has gone that route, and now they've unfortunately watered down those regulations. You know, again, these people are very politically powerful, and they've managed to dilute things a bit. But I think licensing will probably be the way to finally stop this, you know, this scourge of illegal raptor persecution in the UK.
There's so many ideas in every chapter. In the Sagebrush County for the greater sage grouse in Idaho, it can really be summed up, and you write this, is that to identify the problem, you got to don't treat all threats as equal, identify the threat, defend the core, and that's how you make progress. And it's a very detailed program, and we can't get into it now, but it's amazing the success that they've had.
Right. And so the issue with sage grouse is, you know, they're completely dependent on the sagebrush ecosystem, what's known as the sage steppe or the sagebrush sea. And that's an ecosystem that has really suffered a lot of insults over the years. Ranchers for a long time didn't like sagebrush because they thought it competed with grass for forage for their cattle. So they would chain it. They would, you know, drag huge chains between bulldozers and rip the sage out. It's been invaded by invasive annual grasses like cheatgrass that are highly flammable, and so it's become susceptible to these really immense high-intensity fires that burn out the sagebrush. But one of the most insidious threats is one that nobody really noticed for a long time because it's so slow-moving, and that's the encroachment of native conifers into what had been open sagebrush. And sage grouse, there's something about a tree that sage grouse do not trust.
Yeah, they need a big, and wide open space in order to lick.
They do. And as little as one tree per acre can be enough for the sage grouse to completely abandon that area, because trees are what raptors sit on. Trees are what predators sit on. You know, ravens sit on trees and find your nest and eat your babies. And what has happened since Anglo-American colonization in the late 1800s is that the low-intensity wildfires that once burned through every 60 or 80 or 100 years, you know, we stopped those wildfires because we knew that wildfires were bad. But those wildfires controlled the encroachment of western juniper and pinyon pine. And so, you know, when you compare historic photographs from, say, the late 1800s to photographs even as recent, you know, far back as the 1950s, you could see that the land had gone from one or two little tiny trees to a thicket of tiny trees to eventually just a solid juniper conifer forest. And so you have these huge areas across the sagebrush plains where sage grouse lost their habitat because the trees had encroached. And so the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, which is a fairly small and I think to most, especially most Americans in the East, kind of unknown facet of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they were working with ranchers out in places like southeastern Oregon, northern California, Idaho, northern Nevada. And they said, you know, we can make a difference for sage grouse by removing conifers from the landscape, by identifying the core areas. This is that defend the core aspect that you mentioned. the core areas that have not yet been invaded by trees and protect that and make sure that they don't get invaded. And then we can grow the core by looking at areas that have been invaded to some extent, but where we can still remove those trees. And then we can mitigate the damage by working in places like riparian areas, because we know that sage grouse, especially young sage grouse chicks, they eat a lot of insects, they eat a lot of tender forbs and wildflowers early in the spring. So they decided to do this on scale. And that's one of the, you know, one of the criticisms you hear about bird conservation efforts. It's like, okay, the problem is really huge. The solution has to be equally huge in scale.
That's right. And think a lot. We're completely out of time, Scott.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's not your. His book is like that. Trust me. You want to sink into every chapter and visit every place. My guest tonight has been Scott Wiedenthal, writer and researcher specializing in birds and bird migration. And we've been talking about a book. Literally every chapter is a different idea about how to proceed with saving species on the planet. The return of the oyster catcher, saving birds to save the planet. Scott, it's been a pleasure.
Mark, such a pleasure. Really, really enjoyed the conversation.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.